hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to have students with us with our Court with Class program. And they are the Sheboygan Area Lutheran High School. Would the students please stand? And we have a judge with us, too. Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you here with Court with Class, too?
Yes.
Oh, good. I was joshing, but... are you teaching or learning?
Ah. Along with Mr. Fisher.
Good morning, Mr. Fisher. Well, thank you for coming. And now there's extra pressure on our attorneys this morning to show how to do it right so that this team can learn and then be the finalist in the state, right? Sure you can, but back at home. And don't tell us. Thank you. You may be seated. We're all here, as you know, with the Court with Class program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. And it's a national award-winning program. The students have received materials about the case they are about to hear and obviously have consulted with experts about this matter. And the students today, as all the students with the program, will have a presentation by one of the justices at noon. And everyone is invited to come. The presentation will discuss the procedures in the Supreme Court, not the substance of the case. I'll start on my far right to introduce you to the court, as since we've been have had the value of being introduced to you. And on our far right is Justice David Prosser. And Justice Prosser is the judge with whom you will meet at noon today. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my right is Justice William Babich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. And to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, we'll call our first case 01-1910, City of Madison versus Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. According to our notes, Attorney Zach will speak for 20 minutes representing the City of Madison. Attorney Scott Herrick will speak for five minutes representing the Fire Commissioner and the Madison Board of Police and Fire Commissioners. And 15 minutes by Charles Giesen representing Charles T. Wagner, and 15 minutes by Dave Rice, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, Equal Rights Division. Mr. Zach will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Zach, I assume that what I said is in agreement with all of you? Okay.
Yes, and as one point of clarification, Your Honor, I'm here representing the City of Madison and Chief Amesqua and Attorney Herrick, specifically for the Madison Board of Police and Fire Commissioners. May it please the Court, as you know, I'm Steve Zach, and I represent those two parties. There's additional pressure on me today because I'm a high school mock trial coach and have been for 13 years. Congratulations on being in the program, and thanks for coming. And thank you, Court, for sponsoring that program. I know the students at my high school have come up and appreciate it as well. What we are asking as petitioners, respondents, petitioners in this case is that you set aside the Court of Appeals decision in this matter and affirm the ruling or the order of the trial court, which granted us a writ of prohibition that precluded the state of Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development's Equal Rights Division from exercising jurisdiction over a complaint filed by Charles Wagner. Charles Wagner was a firefighter that had been employed by the city of Madison, and his matter had gone through the 62-13-5 proceeding before the Madison Board of Police and Fire Commissioners, which had ordered his termination from employment with the city of Madison, and the city of Madison then complied with that order and terminated him. As you know, he then filed a claim before the Workforce Development asserting discrimination in that action. It is our fundamental position in this matter that 62-13-5, which governs the discharge of police officers and firefighters, is the exclusive process by which the termination order can be reviewed and decided, and that there is not jurisdiction then at the Workforce Development, Department of Workforce Development, to review that issue.
And what expertise does a police and fire commission bring to the question of employment discrimination that is the same as a department whose primary function in these matters is to examine employee discrimination?
Under subsection 4 of 6213, police and fire commissions are specifically requested and ordered to follow the commands of Chapter 111 with respect to their hiring processes. So they're involved in those sort of issues at the front end of involvement with employees at the specific direction of the legislature, and so they work through that. They decide these sort of issues and have competency on a frequent basis. For example, if you have a complaint that is alleged against an officer or a firefighter that officer or firefighter has been involved in sexual harassment, obviously the issue that's going to be before the police and fire commission at that point in time is, was there sexual harassment that occurred? That obviously requires the police and fire commission to delve into Department of Workforce Development law on the topic, and then the law as it has been appealed to either circuit courts through the 227 process or up to the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court. So there is a familiarity with that body of law just by acting in an employment context. I would add to that.
Isn't there an inherent conflict if the Police and Fire Commission has to decide questions involving discrimination, whereas there's no conflict with the Department of Workforce Development because they are essentially a neutral third party?
Well, the Police and Fire Commission, we contend, is a neutral and independent third party. That's a specific reason for its existence. It's why there's a difference between subsection 4 of 6213 and subsection 5. And we're not here contending that the Police and Fire Commission isn't a proper party in subsection 4 matters because that involves employment stuff. What we contend is that the legislature has created this special branch of employees, that is, police officers and firefighters, whose discharge or suspension must be specifically handled in a quasi-judicial matter. That's unlike subsection 4 matters, and it's unlike anything else. I mean, the pure intent of the legislature 100 years ago when they created this process was to isolate those decisions from the political processes to make them an independent body, and I think this court in Eau Claire recognized that it was independent when it ruled that the Civil Service Commission for the counties wasn't exactly like that. So we contend that they are independent.
Can't they file the charge?
Can they file a charge? Yes, they can.
Well, then how does that make them independent?
They're always subject to review by the court if there's any concerns along those lines.
Mr. Zack, in this particular situation, did the Police and Fire Commission in any way consider the claim of Mr. Wagner here that there was discrimination occurring because of his conviction?
We have somewhat of a limited record in this matter before you on that issue. In the record that you have testimony from Chief Amasqua during her deposition, and it's in the briefs that were submitted by the DWD's counsel, that in fact there was a question being raised as to whether or not there was a substantial relationship between the nature of the crime that was committed and the duties of a police officer. So that's at least in the record. Whether or not it was a decision, we don't know by this record, is my belief. My point is, even if they didn't consider that issue and completely missed it in their review of the issue, that is then the issue that goes up to the 62-13-5 reviewing court, the circuit court, for an analysis. And that's where the police officer or the firefighter makes the allegation, look, the PFC dropped the ball in this matter because they're supposed to describe to consider matters of discrimination and didn't.
Following up with what Justice Babich had asked earlier, is there any expertise in the Police and Fire Commission in regard to such questions?
In regard to discrimination questions?
Discrimination specifically tied to conviction, prior conviction.
In the same manner that they would have to consider that in a hiring matter, as directed by the legislature?
Well, your answer would basically be the same.
I agree. And I want to add on to that that this notion of expertise is always protected by the circuit court review under 62-13-5, and that's been one of our points, is that if you see the world in our way and you say, yes, this is solely within the realm of the PSC and the circuit court, the substantive rights of Chapter 111 are going to be protected by that appellate procedure, by circuit courts taking a review of it. So this concern that you're going to have renegade law being created, I don't think is realistic.
What I have just one question, and it's a general one. In the same area here, when we have the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, which is, I think, quite clear, it certainly is as sweeping, at least from a legislative standpoint, I think it's clear that it had a broad application and it is sweeping jurisdiction. The questions of expertise here, mine is basically that how could... Basically, what you're asking us to do is say that that the Police and Fire Commission trumps the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, and I'm talking about your agency is able to as adequately interpret that as the workforce development. That, I guess, basically in the final analysis, that's what we're looking at, aren't we?
The Trump is, I think that's a fair.
Well, maybe, okay.
Okay. But what we're saying is that the Police and Fire Commission makes that decision and not the DWD. But you got to remember, in both cases, at the DWD level and at the PFC level, the people who are going to interpret this are circuit courts eventually. Okay? So it's not, you're not one-on-one. You've got to look at the steps above, too, and that's the protection of those Chapter 111 rights. You also have to remember that the PFCs are not going to be deciding these issues in isolation. They're going to be referring to prior court decisions, appellate and otherwise, and ERD case law in reviewing the answers to their questions.
Why do you care?
Why do we care?
Yeah, it's from me.
Okay. Well, that gets me to what the world looks like if you hold otherwise, okay? And there's some real significant questions. There are some real practical questions. In fact, that was your question was the one we asked right away, is we think we're going to win at ERD. Why not just go there and be done with it? Because we believe the 62-13-5 process is significant, and whereas we think maybe in this case it's an easy call, there are some real significant issues that arise if you hold otherwise, if you hold that we don't trump. One is this case. In this case, Chief Amasqua filed the charges against Firefighter Wagner. And there's been this assertion in the record that she was acting as an agent for the city in that regard. And that's not borne out anywhere in the record. And she's got the right by statute to do that as the fire chief. What if a private citizen files a charge and the PFC sustains that charge, and it goes up to a circuit court who sustains that order, and then the officer of firefighters discharged. And then there's a claim that the discharge, as ordered by the PFC and confirmed by the circuit court, is discriminatory, and so off we go to the DWD. Now, is the private citizen who filed the charge going to be a party to that DWD action just because that private citizen filed the charge? And that's a question you'll have to ask yourselves when you look at the policy issues. Here in the case, we don't want to get muddled by the fact that Chief Omesco's there, who happens to be employee of the city, filing a charge. I think you need to look at other areas, including this private citizen issue. Second issue of the problems of this, why would a municipality incur liability from the DWD merely by following a PFC order? In this case, the charge was filed by Chief Omesqua. The ruling was from the PFC when the PFC ordered, per statute, the municipality, ordered the municipality in this case to terminate the firefighter. Why would a municipality in that circumstance be subject to DWD action when they essentially played no role in the matter and, in fact, may not have even agreed with the decision or have agreed with filing the charges? Third issue, if the PFC can be a party, as two of the members of the Court of Appeals suggest, because it rendered the decision ordering termination, what if we go to a circuit court and the circuit court likewise decides to terminate the officer or sustains the order of the circuit court? If you conclude that the PFC doesn't have immunity, that 62.13.5 doesn't protect the process from DWD examination, then why won't a circuit court who sustains the same order, sustains the order of the PFC, be a party to the DWD action? That's another issue we have. The fourth issue we have is, assuming that we go the route that is argued by the Court of Appeals and that is argued by my opponents, and say, really what we do is 62.13.5 just does just cause issues, whatever that is, and all these discrimination issues can properly go to the DWD. What does the PFC address in those circumstances? If we have a matter that's ultimately or intimately involved in issues that bring in Chapter 111. And the question I have in that circumstance, by not letting the PFC decide those issues of discrimination, are we causing it to discriminate? Will we require it to discriminate? If they can't rule on those issues, by not considering it, are we going to make them discriminate in certain circumstances? And I believe Attorney Herrick's going to speak to you in a little bit about that issue.
But, Counsel, maybe this gets back to one of my initial questions. The issue before the PFC in this case was whether or not Mr. Wagner was terminated with just cause, correct?
Yes, following the seven factors.
Yes. Now, if they decide that, then Mr. Wagner files a complaint with another complaint. You're suggesting that at that point, then Mr. Wagner can come in and say, okay, that was, I was unfairly discriminated against because you took in, because of my criminal record in the hiring process, which strikes me as maybe two different questions. But you're asking the PFC to essentially rule on the correctness of their first decision. Are you not?
Which the first, you said hiring process, and
first decision is whether or not their firing was a just cause.
Yes, the PFC is going to say, are they going to sustain the charges? And in deciding whether they're going to sustain the charges, they have to go through an analysis that's set forth in the statute, which is just cause, with a whole lot of factors, including whether the decision or the proposed action would be discriminatory.
And if they decide that it was discriminatory, what is the relief then that Mr. Wagner has?
He goes to circuit court.
No. Wait. If they decide that it was discriminatory.
If they decide it would be discriminatory, then the charges would not be sustained.
But does Mr. Wagner have any other possible action against them? Can he sue them?
There would be no adverse employment action at that point for him to bring that action. What it is a review. We have charges. His employment status stays the same. He's put on suspension. He's paid. He's compensated as required by the statute during that period of time. The charges are pending, and the employment action doesn't take place. The PFC is the one that creates the employment action by ordering the discharge. So if they don't order the discharge, there's nothing to take the DWD with.
Well, what are the getting at is remedy. What are the remedies that Mr. Wagner has in front of the PFC, and are those the same remedies that he has in front of DWD, or does he have greater remedies?
This is not an action where the officer is saying, I'm being discriminated against.
Okay? That's what his action is in front of DWD.
The action is that the issue before the PFC solely is whether there's going to be termination or suspension. It's not whether or not this person's engaged in discrimination or not. And so I think you need to make clear that all the PFC is doing is, are we going to sustain the charges because of misconduct or some other action and terminate or suspend the officer?
Okay, let's just follow that through. Let us say the PFC decides that there was just cause, fires him, suspends him, terminates him. He goes up to the circuit court and it is affirmed, and he goes all the way up here and it's affirmed. He then goes to the DWD and says, this has all been discriminatory under Chapter 111. And want you to examine this. And the DWD does and says, yep, you're right. There has been discrimination. So what are the remedies under DWD? Get the job back.
Get the job back, get back pay.
Attorney fee, back pay, okay.
Right.
Attorney fees?
Yes.
Any other damages?
Not that I can think of. There are some limited actions where there's front pay if.
So those are the remedies if there's a firing. Now, if there's no firing, he doesn't have to get back pay because he's gotten pay.
Right.
Does he get attorney fees?
No.
No, but he would under DWD.
Well, we're talking, there is no employment action until the termination. That's the point of, they don't get attorney's fees if the PFC had said, we don't sustain the charges, we don't agree. So there are no attorney's fees at that point.
Your position is there's no discrimination until there's an actual termination or some kind of suspension or some kind of job action.
That's exactly right.
And so it is merely an investigation by the administrative agency of an employee. You don't go to DWD yet.
Right. I mean, what the PFC essentially is doing is looking at the facts surrounding the conduct and then making the decision if we do this, is it discriminatory or not?
Well, suppose you have a male employee who thinks he's being sexually harassed. Where does he go?
If the employee thinks he's sexually harassed, that's not a 6213.5 issue. That's a different issue.
And where does he go?
He goes to DWD.
Okay.
That's not this case. This case is the termination order.
So your position is not that everything that involves a firefighter and everything that involves a discrimination case goes to police and fire commission.
That is not our position. It's just the very specific matters that are within the scope of the review of 6213.5, that is the suspension or the discharge that a PFC orders.
And does has the PFC traditionally considered Chapter 11 issues in termination?
I don't have a lot of experience before POCs to tell you that. I can tell you that in the length of time that the Chapter 111 has coexisted with 6213-5, there are no reported cases that we've been able to find or that have been cited in which DWD is exercising jurisdiction over a matter involving a termination or suspension in a 6213-5 setting, which suggests to us that it's been pretty clear out in the practical world that they are doing those things. And it's pretty clear that that's the reason why 91, the legislature was comfortable in putting discrimination in the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Zak.
Thank you,
Your
Honor.
We will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Herrick?
I'm Scott Herrick, the attorney for the Madison Board of Police and Fire Commissioners and co-counsel in this matter. I will speak briefly and I hope concisely about a practical dilemma that the rule in this case may pose for PFCs, and my comments will touch back, I'm sure, on your questions, which have anticipated some of the points that I wanted to address. The foundation for my concerns on behalf of this PFC and all PFCs goes to a fundamental fact, a foundation point, in understanding how PFCs operate under Parent 5. You've touched on this. I want to make it explicit in a slightly different phrase. PFCs impose the discipline. PFCs do not review discipline, they impose it. There is no discipline, meaning the statutory disciplines of discharge, demotion, and suspension. There is no discipline until the PFC imposes the discipline. Therefore, the PFC mechanism is a mechanism not for remedying discrimination, but for preventing it. The allocation, which we view as a comprehensive allocation of all charges and all defenses related to suspension, discharge, and demotion to PFCs, it's a kind of a vertical allocation in the statute. That comprehensive allocation to the PFCs with the structural responsibility then to impose or not impose the discipline, that's the framework in which we're talking and in which it is imperative and really only logical that PFCs consider discriminatory issues along with all the other issues that come before them under Parent 5. Assume the hypothetical case in which there is discrimination. And it took me a long time. It wasn't until I was preparing for argument that I came to that hypothetical as being critical, because I know that in the instant case there was no discrimination. I've been thinking of this case in terms of what happens when there's no discrimination. But assume a case in which there was discrimination and in which the rule is that the PFC cannot consider issues of discrimination in defense. What is the PFC, my client, supposed to do in the hearing? Is it going to exclude that testimony? This body, which isn't even subject to the formal rules of evidence, is going to exclude comments about discrimination and defenses of discrimination because that belongs somewhere else? Is it then going to let it seep in around the edges? Is it going to know the story that there is some discrimination but kind of ignore it and reach the decision without regard to that factor? And, as Mr. Zak said, is in effect the PFC going to be compelled to impose discipline on a discriminatory basis because it is precluded from considering the defense of discrimination?
Well, what if the issue from a hypothetical person such as Mr. Wagner is that in imposing discipline of termination or suspension, the PFC itself was acting discriminatorily? What's his remedy?
His remedy is the appeal, in which the circuit court considers.
But there has been no finding. There's been no record.
Well, why would there not have been a record? I'm not sure I follow that.
Well, because you just got finished telling me that they couldn't determine discrimination issues.
Well, in the instance that I described, the PFC, the hypothetical, would have discriminated because it had to.
And you're assuming the court would hold against you in your hypothetical.
In my hypothetical, the circuit court would be required to sustain. Because it could have not consider the issues of discrimination.
Because the DWD would have exclusive authority.
That's correct.
Your hypothetical.
That's my hypothetical. The resolution is, and I will, in stating how I would resolve this, I'll allude to a question that was asked earlier. The resolution is what I regard as the current law, which is that the PFC considers, at the beginning, de novo, in its quasi-judicial capacity, everything, including discrimination questions, just as I have advised my clients. You have to look at discrimination. When they put the words discrimination into the seven standards, they weren't changing the law, they were just adding to it. The PFC must consider discrimination from the beginning, not only as a defense, but also, and don't ignore this either, and this goes to your expertise questions, as a charge. Where is a chief going to go who wants to discipline an officer because that officer has behaved in a discriminatory manner? There is only one place to bring those charges. Nobody, I think, contends that there is any other agency, Equal Rights Division or anywhere else, to go to discipline an officer who has been discriminating. You go to the PFC. So the PFC hears charges alleging discrimination, if they arise. The PFC conducts appointment procedures, hiring and promotion, under Parent 4, with a full eye to discrimination questions. Certainly it should hear discrimination defenses when it is considering whether or not to impose discipline. And I see my red light is on.
Thank you, Mr. Herrick. Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. Eason?
May it please the court, my name is Charles Giesen, and I represent Charles Wagner, who was formerly a Madison firefighter and who served the department with distinction for several years until he was terminated because of a misdemeanor theft conviction for conduct which had occurred prior to his having been hired by the department. Mr. Wagner was the only Madison firefighter who had ever been terminated because of a misdemeanor conviction. In his view, that termination constituted a violation of the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, and he filed his complaint with the Department of Workforce Development to vindicate his rights under the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act.
Mr. Giesen, was the conviction after he had been hired?
Yes. The incident occurred in 1992. He was hired in 1993 and served until 1997 when the charge was brought, and he was then suspended. And I would beg to differ with my colleague that it is only the PFC that can impose adverse employment sanctions, because in this very case, Mr. Wagner suffered adverse employment consequences by virtue of that suspension.
There are disciplinary actions that can be taken by a chief, and then the employee can appeal basically to the Police and Fire Commission. Isn't that correct? Or ask for review by the Police and Fire Commission?
That's correct. That's at the firefighter's option to seek review.
Mr. Giesen, if the conviction had occurred prior to the time that Mr. Wagner was hired, would the chief and the department have been authorized not to hire him?
That depends on the application of the Fair Employment Act provision that the conviction must be substantially related to the circumstances of employment. And that's the fallacy or flaw in the city's position. When the PFC determines this, and in this particular case, there was never any substantial relationship analysis performed by the PFC, nor did the PFC in its lengthy written decision ever mention the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act or that it had ever given consideration to that. And that's why, one of the reasons why the PFC is not the appropriate body to make determinations under the Fair Employment
Counsel,
Act.
Counsel, suppose the appeal had been, or the review had been properly submitted to the circuit court, would you have made that argument to the circuit court that the PFC erred as a matter of law in not considering this issue of discrimination and that the ruling violated Chapter 111?
No, because under the existing state of the law, particularly the Bakand case, the Department of Workforce Development has the exclusive authority in the state to review matters pertaining to the Fair Employment Act. Evidence of that is apparent also and that it was the city's view, because in the employment contract that's cited in the amicus brief of the Firefighters Union, there's an express provision that any alleged violation of any state or federal laws governing discrimination shall be determined by the agency that is charged with enforcing and administering those laws.
Well, then you would have just gone to circuit court, not argued that, kept the circuit court in the dark, proceeded on to the Supreme Court on some other issue, and then at the same time litigating DWD?
No, that would not have happened, because under the appellate mechanism, the circuit court review is final and conclusive. That's one of the strong policy reasons we urge the court to consider. What you have throughout the state is hundreds of PFCs. They can make their determinations with no expertise whatsoever relative to the WFEA, and the only review of that decision is to the circuit court. The circuit court's decision is final and conclusive. There is no opportunity for the Court of Appeals or this court to further review that decision or to develop a consistent statewide body of law pertaining to the application of the Fair Employment Act, as this court has frequently done in the past. So in effect, you would have 250-plus circuit judges in this state applying their interpretations of the Fair Employment Act with no opportunity for any review by this court or the Court of Appeals.
Are there other procedural differences or differences in available remedies, as inquired to previously, that distinguish the two avenues of recourse?
There are very substantial, so substantial, while they may be characterized as procedural, they become substantive. For instance, under the statute, each PFC, and I should preface this by saying that the PFC's members are political appointees whose only qualification is that no more than three of them be the member of the same political party. That's it. But each PFC throughout the state is free to formulate its own rules under Chapter 62 for the application of the disciplinary proceedings. And they have done that in widely disparate manners. Some PFCs prohibit any discovery other than exchange of witness lists. Some limit the hearing to 60 minutes. Very few of them permit any discovery other than a simple exchange of exhibits. So if I, representing a litigant wishing to assert a DWD claim, attempt to do that before the PFC, I don't have the opportunity or the discovery abilities to obtain documents to depose witnesses, whereas the DWD affords a claimant the full benefits of Chapter 804 of the statutes, the right to depose witnesses, to subpoena documents, to really prepare a case, as you must do, to present it properly for trial.
Can I go back to my first question? Are you saying that a fire department must hire or cannot discriminate against a person in hiring who has been convicted of theft?
No, I'm saying that a fire department, the Police and Fire Commission, is explicitly bound by the terms of the Fair Employment Act that says they may not discriminate. And if a person applied and perhaps had a lengthy history of arson convictions or theft of fire department engines, things that could be substantially related, they were a pyromaniac. Clearly, that conviction would substantially relate to the circumstances of the employment, and could be taken into account under the Fair Employment Act.
But in this case, Chief Amesqua gave some rationales to why a firefighter should not have been convicted of theft.
That was collateral testimony. I don't think that was ever considered by the Police and Fire Commission. There was not the substantial relationship analysis performed by the Police and Fire Commission. And Chief Amesqua also took the blanket position that she would never hire anyone who had been convicted of a theft. That means that somebody who is a juvenile, had a theft conviction, she would apply that blanket prohibition against any person with any type of conviction, regardless of whether or not it pertained to the circumstances of the job. And that's the violation of the Fair Employment Act, to not consider that. If I may follow up on Justice Bradley's question with regard to remedies, I mentioned the procedures. The Fair Employment Act and the DWD has vastly different and more expansive remedies at its disposal, which are necessary to effectuate its purposes, as declared by the legislature. For instance, it can award front pay, differential compensation. Mr. Wagner, as he noted in his statement, lost certain other benefits while he was suspended, including overtime pay, restoration of seniority. The DWD can issue a cease and desist order against the employer to prohibit further discriminatory conduct. It can also award attorney's fees to a successful litigant under the private attorney general theory. And none of those remedies are available to a police and fire commission under Chapter 62.13. If this court were to adopt the city's position, it would have to virtually rewrite or reenact the provisions of Section 62.13 to make available all of those remedies that the Fair Employment Act provides.
Let's suppose that the Police and Fire Commission had made a decision that he should not be terminated, that this was not related to this conviction was not related to his job, and that his charges are dropped, gets back pay, everything's just dandy. Would you go to the DWD?
He would have that right and that option.
What would he get?
Well, he would be entitled to be made whole.
In my scenario, what's making whole mean?
The attorney's fees he had to incur.
Even though there's been no job suspension.
Well, there is an adverse job action because while the PFC proceedings are pending, he's suspended. He loses overtime pay. He loses tuition opportunities, educational opportunities, training opportunities, interest on the award, which is available under the DWD.
So even if you make a charge against somebody and then it turns out it's a discriminatory charge, DWD provides remedies. Is that what you're telling us?
In our view, yes. It's the city's view, as I understand it, that a person in such a situation would simply have to take their lumps and have no recourse.
But what is the discriminatory act under that scenario if there is no termination? If he's cleared, in other words, of the charges, what is the act of discrimination?
Well, if the charges were based on a prohibited discriminatory act such as arrest record,
What is the act of discrimination?
Suspension from duty. and loss of all of the benefits that go with that, including overtime pay.
Is there an entitlement to overtime pay?
Well, it's a practical matter. It's something they expect. No, there isn't.
There is no entitlement to that, and there's no entitlement to the other things that you mentioned either. He's suspended with pay. He has suffered no discriminatory act or adverse consequences until there's been a termination.
Well, somebody who is not able to report for duty, I think the fact of suspension is recognized by the courts as an adverse action.
He's compensable if there are no losses.
He would have had to have incurred attorney's fees to defend himself before the PFC at the hearing. And the PFC...
That's provided by the union, isn't it?
No, it is not.
The union doesn't provide representation before the PFC?
No. It may in some instances. I know certainly that Mr. Wagner did not receive a cent from the union and had to undertake and bear the full expense of his own representation.
Is that customary throughout the state? Is it customary that unions provide representation before the PFC?
I don't believe so. I don't think it's fair to say that anything is customary throughout the state, and that's part of the problem with having all these different PFCs in every city over 4,000 population throughout the state prosecute these matters and why they're incapable of or should not, when contrasted with the expertise of the DWD, the experience it has in administering the Fair Employment Act, they are not an appropriate body to determine that.
When you look at the broad picture, it just seems so messy to have two administrative agencies. One, you say, you consider whether this person should be terminated for just cause, but don't consider discrimination or anything related to it. You just go along your merry track, and including the circuit court, and I don't understand why they can't appeal to the Court of Appeals after a circuit court decision about the PFC. So you got that little track going, and then at the same time you got another track going on discrimination. Doesn't make sense. Now, I know statutes and law don't always make sense, but your initial reaction is they should, and you try and interpret them in a way that does make sense. So tell me how you make sense out of this.
It's probably not an ideal situation, but you make sense out of it by recognizing that there are two distinctly different matters at issue here. One is the protection of all of the citizens of the state, including firefighters and policemen, to be free from employment discrimination. The other is an attempt to provide some sort of uniform procedure for imposing disciplinary proceedings. The purposes are distinctly different. The remedies of necessity must be different, and that's why it can't be handled in one neat package. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Assistant Attorney General Rice.
May it please the Court, my name is David Rice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and in this case I represent the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Regardless of which way this case is decided, I commend to the Court, whoever is lucky enough to have to draft the opinion, the language from the Byers case at page 208, Wisconsin 2nd, page 394, paragraphs 15 and 16 of the Court's decision. Here's what you said. The legislature has adopted two statutes, in that case, the Workers' Compensation Act, but you could substitute 6313, and the WFEA, to address different kinds of work-related harms and to provide different remedies for the harms. One does not expect these two statutes to conflict with each other, yet this case appears to raise just such a conflict. We begin by noting that neither statute expressly mentions the other, yet, as the present case demonstrates, in this case, 6213 and the WFEA are both potentially applicable to the same set of facts. And that's, I think, a fair description of why we're here and why this is a difficult case. The questions of jurisdiction for police and fire commissions seems to be in vogue at the moment. There's probably two other cases pending before you. There have been several cases litigated in the last several years trying to determine where a disciplined police and fire police officer or firefighter goes to have certain issues resolved. In the City of Janesville case, for instance, the Court of Appeals said the firefighter is precluded from going from proceeding under a collective bargaining agreement, and 6213 provides the exclusive remedy. Yet in this court, in a split decision, the majority concluded that with respect to civil service commissions, under, I think, Chapter 58, the result is the opposite. Now, in this case, you have a longstanding history, probably under both statutes, of exclusive authority. You have the line of cases leading up through Janesville that says the police and fire commissions have exclusive authority, at least with respect to competing collective bargaining agreements, to decide questions of discipline and to decide just cause questions. You have a history of cases dating back to 1957 under the Fair Employment Act saying that with respect to discrimination, the Department of Workforce Development and its predecessor agencies is the exclusive body to decide questions under the Fair Employment Act. But here you have a case where arguably either statute could apply to the same set of facts. And you have, the, on the one hand, the practical consequence that Justice Abramson's alluded to, in which the city argues, of having duplicative hearings, and isn't that bad public policy? Then you have the other side, our side, arguing, do we really have sufficient expertise in these police and fire commissions to address these questions of discrimination? Now, Justice Abramson, the reason that you cannot go beyond the circuit court in a case involving the Police and Fire Commission was a case that preceded your tenure on the court. Jendrzewski versus Board of Police and Fire Commissions, 257 Wisconsin 2nd, 536, in
it's
which...
It's not Wisconsin 2nd, 257 Wisconsin 2nd.
You're right, we're not that... We haven't gotten that far yet.
That's the page number.
Right. I don't know that I have the page number.
That's okay.
But that case has been followed in other cases, and it takes the final and conclusive language from the statute, the 6213 statute, and says you can't go any further. Now, some members of the court were former circuit court judges. We have a present circuit court judge in the courtroom. And with all deference to those circuit court judges who work very hard and interpret the law, the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, if left to be resolved by each circuit court judge, would have a lack of uniformity. And those circuit judges would not act as they do in cases arising from appeals from the Department of Workforce Development with the benefit of the review by not only the Department of Workforce Development hearing examiners, many of whom have been on the job for 10 or 20 years, but the Labor and Industry Review Commission, which is a reviewing body that provides for a single voice on questions arising under the Fair Employment Act. So there's some practical policy issues which will cause the court to come out one way or another. In Byers, you seem to be persuaded by the fact that there were different remedies. There are different remedies here. Mr. Giesen's alluded to them. There are different procedures here. If these cases are going to be litigated before the police and fire commissions, as a result of your decision, at least going into those cases, unlike Mr. Wagner, the parties will know ahead of time that they are obligated to litigate the fair employment questions in the context of the 6213 case, and the police and fire commissions, in turn, will know in advance that it's their obligation to decide those questions.
What is to be used to curtail potential abuse? That is, I'm suspended, and Mr. Giesen has suggested that that can be a discriminatory act. So I'm suspended. Now, if I'm suspended, of course, it's not my fault. It's never my fault. It's someone else's fault, right? And so they're suspending me, I think, because either I'm too old, or maybe because of my religion, or because of my bum knee, or because of my marital status, or messy marital status, or my sexual orientation. It's never my fault. So what precludes any person, if I were suspended and if I were a smart defense attorney, maybe, I would say, okay, let's file with VWD. Doesn't that just mess up this cross-pollination, mess up any kind of efficiency in the whole process?
Well, I think, first of all, and I was going to get to Justice Sykes' comment on that, I think that it's actionable to, under the Fair Employment Act, to suspend somebody because of a conviction record or because of an arrest, unless there's a substantial relationship between the pending charge. In the case of arrest, it's always impermissible, but in the case of a pending charge, whether there's a substantial relationship, regardless of whether or not it would constitute an adverse employment action. And there is law, and I think you know that law, that says that there must be an adverse employment action or the law doesn't become effective. And that's an issue that's being litigated in the lower courts and has not reached this court yet. But to get to your specific question, the issue is not going to end up being resolved by the Department of Workforce Development Hearing Officer or by the Labor and Industry Review Commission within the time parameters that the Police and Fire Commission is going to complete its decision, just because the Police and Fire Commission under 6213 is held to a specific time frame. And just as a practical matter, it's going to take years, literally, before a case winds its way from the intake at the Department of Workforce Development to a final resolution by the Labor and Industry Review Commission. Now, what about Mr. Zack's point? What happens if you have a determination of just cause? Doesn't it lead to a potential for an inconsistent result in order from the Department of Workforce Development? Here's the way I'd answer that question. In 186 with second, I think it's page 603, the Court of Appeals considered the question of whether the in part test, which this court developed in labor relations cases, would apply in cases arising under the Fair Employment Act, and the answer was yes. And what that means is where there is a permissible reason for termination, in this case there was just cause for the termination arguably, and there also is impermissible reason that it may be discriminatory under the State Fair Employment Act, what is the agency and in turn the courts to do? And under the in part test, if the person would have been terminated because of the just cause, and it's not a but-for situation, then the remedy is limited. You cannot get a full panoply of remedies if the result would not have occurred but for the discriminatory act. So the way that that can be handled is that the agency, in the first instance, and the courts on review can assure that where there has been just cause established, that the remedy is fashioned in a way that takes that into account.
What, I don't believe you cited that case in your brief.
I did not cite it in my brief.
What is the name of it? You gave us the cite. But
I'll give you the exact cite. I've heard it pronounced two different ways, Hoel or Hale, H-O-E-L-L versus L-I-R-C, 186 West 2nd, 603.
It goes to remedy?
It goes to remedy.
But here, the just cause and the discrimination are one and the same issues in this case. The just cause is that he has a conviction. The discrimination is you can't fire me because I have a conviction.
Right.
So I don't know why the remedy case helps you. I mean, it would if you got three just causes and one of them is discriminatory.
Right.
But here, the total overlap, or maybe I'm wrong. I accept that as an answer. But you better justify it.
No, I wouldn't be afraid to tell you if I thought you were wrong, but I don't think you're wrong in this context. There are cases potentially where that's not going to be true, where the Fair Employment Act imposes affirmative obligations like the duty of reasonable accommodation, areas of creed and disability. Even in this case, one could say that the issue is whether or not the rule was applied without discrimination, and that's only the question of whether he, Wagner, was treated differently than other persons because of the conviction. And it could be argued, and I'm not sure that you'll find this convincing, that the Fair Employment Act would address, assuming that they fire everybody who's convicted, is it permissible under the Fair Employment Act to fire the person in this particular case because there is an absence of substantial relationship? So there's arguably a distinct question, but we've done two moot courts on this, and that's a point where we always have difficulty. I wanted to touch on Justice Prosser's question. He asked, do you mean to say that a fire department can't fire somebody can't terminate somebody who has been convicted? And the answer is, the Fair Employment Act says, no, you cannot fire somebody who's been convicted unless the employer satisfies the decision maker that there's a substantial relationship between the crime and the job. Now, under County Milwaukee, this court's decision, that may not be that difficult to do, but it's still required. But I can't address that in this case, nor should anybody address that, because that issue never has been resolved. And that's part of the point that I've been trying to make, is that here we have a capable police and fire commission. We have an able counsel to the police and fire commission. And yet they didn't even apply the law in this case.
What expertise does DWD have to evaluate the relationship of a criminal conviction to the work of the police department or the fire department?
Well, the DWD has probably 20 years of experience in deciding these cases with the guidance of the Court of Appeals and with this court. Those are bread and butter issues that they hear.
They have 20 years experience on fair employment, but what experience do they have in the Madison Fire Department?
They have no experience in the Madison Fire Department. And Mr. Zack is correct. I have been unable to unearth any case involving an application of the Fair Employment Act to a police and fire commission in the context that we have here. There is this court's case in La Crosse, but that was a hiring case where the police and fire commission excluded somebody because of a back condition. But there is no case. There's no case right on point. But when you look at agency expertise, as this court has looked at it, you don't look at its expertise in applying it to a unique set of facts. You look at its expertise in applying the law to several differing sets of facts.
Could I ask one question? If a state employee was convicted of theft and there was a process to terminate that person by the state, is that through the Personnel Commission, or how does that?
Yes, it is currently through the Personnel Commission.
All right. Now, does DWD get to second guess the Personnel Commission?
No. This court has the Personnel Commission has been given authority to apply the Fair Employment Act, at least currently, in cases involving state employees, and all other cases go to the Department of Workforce Development and turn to the Labor and Industry Review Commission. This court has also determined that the Personnel Commission, in applying the Fair Employment Act, is entitled to deference because of its expertise garnered over that same period of time.
I missed the first part of your response. Under what authority did the Personnel Commission get this authority? Is it a statute or a case?
It's 111.39 sub 2, I think. It's just a statutory division of authority. So, I guess one last point that I would make is on the question of how did those seven standards come about? What that was a political compromise. The unions didn't like the result that the Court of Appeals reached in the city of Janesville and went to the legislature and tried to get the legislature to pass a bill, and it's in my brief, and the bill would have permitted a firefighter or law enforcement officer to proceed to arbitration as an alternative to proceeding under 6213. And that initial legislation as introduced failed to pass. And so the compromise that was reached was that they would have the police and fire commissions make these decisions, but that they would act as if they were arbitrators by applying these same arbitration standards, one of which is this provision without discrimination. And I see my red light is on, but in my brief I address the reason why I don't believe that incorporates, and clearly the language does not incorporate, and 6213 does not incorporate the entirety of the Fair Employment Act.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Mr. Zack, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think it's important to note the facts under which, under the reason we're here. Mr. Giessen said that he would not have raised the issues pertaining to discrimination on a circuit court review, but the record will reveal that the circuit court appeal, the 62-13-5 issue, was dismissed on February 23, 2000, and then the DWD action was filed shortly thereafter on March 2, 2000.
Is a 62-13 sub 5 EM hearing, just cause hearing, a plenary sort of proceeding where the PFC is charged with the responsibility of ascertaining whether the proposed discipline is in compliance with all state law?
That would be our interpretation. At least in terms of Chapter 111, we agree it would, because there's a specific reference that it has to be without discrimination. The other point, and this is the argument that the Court of Appeals raised, or the point the Court of Appeals raised, and it's in footnote 11 of the Court of Appeals decision, is one of the department rules that the PFC found just cause to conclude that Wagner violated was a firefighter's obligation to obey all laws. One could argue that if that department rule conflicts with WIFA, it could not be reasonable under WIS Stat Section 62-13-5. So I think in another vein, if we were talking about other statutes other than Chapter 111, that would probably factor into the reasonableness portion of the standards.
Is it customary, though, for a PFC, when deciding whether or not to impose discipline in an individual case, to sort of engage in a roving analysis about whether the proposed discipline complies with all potentially applicable state law?
Yeah. Mr. Herrick is nodding yes. He's more involved in those sort of direct line contacts, but that's my understanding. It certainly is under the seven standards something that needs to be factored under the reasonableness of the rule or the action that's being taken.
So your argument would be that it would be unreasonable if the proposed discipline violated
state law? Yes, okay. Just in this case. Let me speak to Byers real quickly and why that's not applicable. In Byers, you've got a real bad actor employer who's doing nasty things, and the employees sitting there with a decision to make. Do I go to the Fair Employment Act for discrimination, or am I precluded by the workers' comp bar in that case? In that case, neither the workers' comp division nor the DWD is an actor in that employment action giving rise to the remedies. In this case, under 62-13-5, you've got the PFC doing the employment action, the termination, making the order. Okay. And the issue then is, does DWD have jurisdiction over the PFC in that case? Okay. In Byers, you've got the Workers' Comp Act and the Fair Employment Act sitting side by side as remedies. Here you've got action by the PFC under statute, pursuant to statute, and then a remedy down here. And so though these are not comparable cases, this is not a Byers sort of analysis. One final point to make is regarding the suspension issue. Again, our point is that there isn't any adverse employment action until the PFC rules. Suspension occurs pursuant to statute. The chief or the board are given the right to suspend under 62-13-5 sub B. But if they do so, subsection H says that no person shall be deprived of compensation while suspended pending disposition of charges. Okay? Suspension isn't the employment action or a result of any action. Suspension is only because there are pending charges at that point in time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zack and Mr. Herrick and Giessen and Rice for presenting this difficult issue this morning. That ends our hearing in 01-1910, City of Madison versus Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. We'll take a few moments in recess while these students leave, but come back at noon to hear Justice Prosser, and we'll let additional students come in if they were able to brave the weather and the highways, as the Sheboygan students did. We're in recess for a few moments.
Thank you.